From the studios of EWTN, this is Open Line. Today's Open Line is recorded, so no calls, please. If you'd like to send us an email for a future show, the address is openline@ewtn.com.
Hey, tremendous Monday to each and every one of you. Thanks so much for tuning in to EWTN's Open Line. This is a very special mailbag edition of EWTN's Open Line Monday, so we won't be taking your phone calls today. But if you would like to be part of a future mailbag edition, just send us an email. The email address is openline@ewtn.com. I'm Jack Williams. Pedro Quiles producing the program, and our host, as he is every Monday, Father John Trigilio. And Father John,
yes,
we're going back to the 100-question email that we dip into from time to time.
Okay,
and we're going to knock out some more.
Open the vault. Open the vault.
We're going to knock out some more of these bullet points. First up, we finished the first page.
Wow.
And so when we finished the last question on the first page, I threw the thing away, and the thing had all the emailer's address on info on it. So I forgot what the emailer's name is, but I'm sure he knows who he is.
John Smith.
Yeah, that's right. First question, is a mass containing liturgical abuses illicit?
Ooh, that's a very good question. It would be illicit in this sense that if the priest knowingly, purposely, intentionally violates the rubrics, it would still be valid if he uses wheat bread and great wine and says the words of consecration, this is my body, this is my blood. But let's say he doesn't wear the proper vestments. He doesn't wear any vestments, or he just throws a stole over his lay clothes, doesn't wear the alb or the chasuble, all the other parts if he messes with that, it would be illicit, meaning it's illegal, but it's still valid. And so anyone go into that Mass, it would be a valid Mass. So if it was Sunday, it would fulfill their obligation. The Holy Eucharist would be valid. But the priest would be guilty, of sacrilege. And it certainly is not the highest level, which would be the most egregious, where it would be invalid as well as illicit. But priests, we're not there to take shortcuts, and we have to, prudently and reverently realize that, this is not my Mass. It belongs to Christ and to his church.
Again, a special mailbag edition of Open Line Monday. We're dipping into our 100-question email that was sent to us last year. And the next on our hit parade, Father, can the sign of peace at Mass be omitted?
Yes, it is optional. When you look in the rubrics, which is the general structure of the Roman Missal, the word may, it's subjunctive. It doesn't say must, And so, and I know certainly if you watch it on television, you'll see the televised Mass, it's optional. Many parishes, it's up to the priest. These are options the priest has. In the same way, when he begins Mass, he can say very short, the Lord be with you and with your spirit, or the grace of God the Father, the communion of the Holy Spirit, the love of God. You can say other words that are in the text. You can use Eucharistic Prayer 1, the Roman Canon. You can use number 2, number 3, or number 4. So the priest has legitimate options at his discretion there, and one of them is that the sign of peace. Now, if I wasn't going to use them, and I must say that as a pastor for 16 years, there are many times I would not, particularly like on the weekday, I would let people know. I would say, not at the Mass itself, but at some time to let them know that there are some options that I exercise, but why I'm doing that. Because you don't want to insult people's intelligence. You don't want to say, well, it's my Mass, I'll do what I want. In the same way with the type of vestments, some guys like more Gothic, some like the what they call the Roman style, some like a little lace on their alb, some don't. De gustibus non disputandum est. There is no argument on taste.
It's a liturgical mailbag edition of EWTN's Open Line Monday.
Romano Gardini.
Next on the hit parade, does the subdeacon have a place in the Novus Ordo?
Well, there is no subdeacon in the ordinary form. Paul VI, when he revised the ministries after the Second Vatican Council, the subdiaconate was sort of assumed into the office of the acolyte. And so we don't have someone who dresses in what would look like a dalmatic. It was not technically a dalmatic, but it looked like it. And then you would have the subdeacon, the deacon, and then the priest. But we don't have that minor office anymore in the Latin Rite. They do in the Eastern Rite, in the Byzantine Church, in the Eastern Catholic Rite. There are subdeacons, and they're not extraordinary form. They have their own liturgical rite. But in what we would see, like here on EWTN on televised mass, the ordinary form, the Novus Ordo, there's no one functioning as a subdeacon because there is no role for the subdeacon. Now, in the ancient rite, the extraordinary form, the subdeacon would do certain things, prepare the chalice, but only the deacon would be the one to, you know, prepare the chalice and the paten to give to the priest. It's a non sequitur at this point.
Again, a special mailbag edition of EWTN's Open Line Monday. Next up, is a priest allowed to say the universal prayer? He asks because the general instruction is a little unclear in paragraph 138.
Well, it's something that can be done properly by the deacon if he's there. If there's no deacon, then the lector is allowed to, and in place of that, then the priest would do it in the what we call the ordinary form or the Novus Ordo Mass. If it's omitted, the priest is allowed to omit it for serious reasons. But I don't want to insult people's intelligence and not tell them why. I exercise certain options. I'm not going to explain every single thing I'm doing, though. I'm not saying, well, I'm on page 45 in case you want to know.
It's not a paraliturgy.
No.
Again, we're answering some of the emails in our 100 bullet point email that we received last year from a dear listener. All right, Father, you might want to explain the question before you answer the question here, just for some of our listeners who may not be familiar with the terminology. He wants to know who is allowed to wear the mozzetta during Mass.
The mozzetta, okay, that looks like somebody ripped off the top half of a cassock. Okay, it's a cloth. It looks like the cassock. Now, interestingly enough, I have one because I'm a knight of the Constantinian Order of Saint George, and we have is like a blue green mozzetta that you wear on top of the surplice that's on top of the cassock. Bishops have a purple mozzetta that they wear over the surplice, over the cassock. The cardinals have a red mozzetta. It's similar to a shoulder cape, but the shoulder cape is not connected in the front. The mozzetta has buttons, and like I said, it looks just like the top half of a cassock, but it's worn on top of the cassock, but also under with the surplice on top of that. It's usually as a sign of rank for the episcopacy. So a bishop would wear purple, a cardinal would wear red. Now the Pope, because he's supreme head of the church, he has the privilege of wearing a special mozzetta that's made of silk and has some ermine on there, okay? So sometimes you may have seen pictures of either Pope Leo. I don't think Pope Francis wore it often, but Pope Benedict certainly did. And at Easter time, he would also wear the white one that was very striking. But the mozzetta is something that is worn not by the celebrant. It's when the priest or the bishop is what they say in choir. He's not celebrating the Mass. He's in attendance. And then they would wear if they're the bishop, they would wear the pectoral cross on top of that.
And following that up, who is allowed to wear the pellegrina during Mass?
The pellegrina, you have to refresh my memory on that one.
Can't help you. I'm a convert.
Oh, well, there you go. See, you got to get one of those Catholicism games that
yeah, yeah, have. Yeah. I do happen to belong to a parish where the extraordinary form is offered, but I don't know what a pellegrina is. All right, very good. Can altar cards be used in the Novus Ordo?
I would say yes. I've used.
I've seen them, especially right after the translation. They were everywhere.
Oh, that was exactly
the updating of the translation.
When we tweaked the translation, thanks to Pope Benedict, I had them made. I had them laminated, so that, you know, because sometimes it's difficult to flip through the missal.
And
this was convenient. Now, most people, when they hear about the Mass cards, they're familiar with the three traditional ones that they would place on the altar at a 90-degree angle, so the priest could look at that and he didn't need to use the missal for some of the prayers. And certainly the Roman canon was in there, the last gospel that was read at the end of Mass, some of the very beginning. But you can still use it. I would just say not have it as prominent as it was in the extraordinary form.
It's a very special mailbag edition of EWTN's Open Line Monday, so we're not taking your calls today. But if you'd like to be part of a future mailbag show, send us an email, openline@ewtn.com.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Today's Open Line is recorded, so no calls, please. If you'd like to send us an email for a future show, the address is openline@ewtn.com.
Again, a special mailbag edition of Open Line Monday. We're not taking your calls today. We are ticking off some of the bullet points in our 100-question email that we received early last year. Next up, now, Father, this one I can help you with if you need me to. Simply because Father Mitch and I did a little research on this for an Open Line caller. Is a deacon/server allowed to lift the priest's chasuble during the consecration in the Novus Ordo?
I would say there's nothing that prohibits it. I don't remember seeing anything in the general instruction that says it's not allowed. It was done in the extraordinary form. And I know there's two schools of thought. One, which is much more American, that if it's not explicitly stated to do it, then you shouldn't do it. But then there's the more Roman or Italian school that says if it's not forbidden, it's allowed. Particularly if some of these vestments, because they're more, there's a lot more material and they're heavier, and you don't want, you know, to assist the priest, particularly when he's elevating the chalice and the host, or even when he's incensing, I see nothing wrong with that. So I would say yes.
I would suggest, and I agree with that answer, I would suggest to you that it's really rarely possible or necessary in the Novus Ordo, simply because the chances of seeing someone vested in fiddleback vestments are highly unlikely.
This is true, although some of us, I have some nice fiddleback or what we call Roman vestments, and some of them, again, it's because of the weight and the way in which they fall on the person. It was always started as a practical convenience, and then some spiritual meditation was added to it, so that this idea that they were assisting in the elevation. But yes, I've particularly find that some of these things that we've done that you can still do are edifying. But again, I would like to explain every now and then to people why we do these little things, you know, like when you make the little sign of the cross on your forehead and on your lips and on your heart before the gospel, just to remind them of that. Where does this come from? What does it mean?
Yeah. Based on our research, apparently back in the day, like centuries ago, those vestments were incredibly heavy. And the priest actually needed assistance
to get his arms up, just to
elevate the host. Yeah,
yeah. And I've seen some of those. In fact, Father Briganti and I wore some of those. We went to the Christopher Columbus Museum in Bowlesburg, Pennsylvania, and one of the Bowl family married a descendant of Christopher Columbus, and they had the actual vestments that were worn by the Dominican priest who celebrated Mass on the Santa Maria. We wore it on Columbus Day in 1992 for the quincentenary, and they weighed a ton.
Again, a special mailbag edition of Open Line Monday, so we're not taking your calls today. Here's a good one, Father, and this one you might kind of speak to the distinctions between the extraordinary form and the ordinary form. Are acclamations and responses from the faithful required?
No, not in the extraordinary form. It certainly is allowed. Certainly, Pius XII made it clear he wanted some more vocal participation, so people were invited. In fact, it was sometimes called the dialogue mass. But when it first started, the requirement was for the faithful to be present. And he even talks about in his encyclicals on the sacred liturgy that participation is not limited to, and it's not the highest form is that you do speak these responses, and it's more than just your physical presence, that you internally, okay, you internally participate. You're open to God's grace, so that if it's a language you don't understand, whether it's, say, in Latin, or maybe it's a vernacular you don't understand, if you don't speak Spanish and you're in a Spanish Mass, you can still participate by opening yourself up to God's grace and saying, I am getting into what is happening here. So the responses, now today, sometimes people think that the response are the only way to participate, and we say no, that's not the case. But certainly with the ordinary form, the Novus Ordo Mass, the people are encouraged to make those responses. But in some cases where the choir is making singing the response, you're not leaving the people out, because they're present there as part of the mystical body of Christ.
And correct me if I'm wrong, Father, and I may very well be, but my understanding is that in its truest sense, at a low celebration of the extraordinary form, the server is actually responding on behalf of the people.
Yes.
And during a high mass, the choir is responding on behalf of the people.
Yes, that was certainly the understanding for centuries. And like I said, it was until the 1950s where Pope Pius XII very explicitly encouraged the faithful to join in when they could, obviously if the choir was singing. But in fact, even when a priest celebrates Mass without the faithful, he is highly, highly, highly encouraged to have at least someone there to help serve. If he can't find one, he still can celebrate Mass, which we would improperly say by himself or a private Mass, but he's encouraged to have someone to make those responses. So that's why sometimes priests would say, I'll serve for you, you serve for me. So if the priest said Mass, another priest would help, say, be his server, and then they would reverse the roles. But now that you can have concelebrated Masses, the priest who's concelebrating with you, he can do the responses.
Again, a special mailbag edition of Open Line Monday, so we're not taking your calls today. If you'd like to be part of a future mailbag show, you can send us an email. The email is openline@ewtn.com. And today, we are answering some of the questions that came to us from a listener. Very heartfelt, legitimate questions that they just want answers to. We're at a portion of the 100 or so questions that were sent in that are asking for distinctions primarily between the Novus Ordo and the extraordinary form of the sacred liturgy. And Father, it might be a good idea here to just for 1 second reflect on the fact that regardless of what your personal preference may be, it is imperative that you not go beyond the bounds of what Holy Mother Church has said is okay.
Absolutely. Because one must not only sentire cum ecclesia, think with the church, but also act with the church, agere, so that you might be going to a valid Mass, but if they're not in full communion with the Holy See, you're not really setting a good example. You could go to a Russian or Greek Orthodox church, it's a valid Holy Eucharist, but they're not going to want you to go to communion, and we're not going to want you to go to communion, even though it's valid, because we're not in communion with each other. And if you go to a schismatic group, it may be totally valid, but if they're not in full communion, you're setting a bad precedent. It's also what appears, and it's not just we're into, outward externals, but that's part of it, okay? You want to be internally and externally on the same page as Holy Mother Church.
Next up, is there something that is not explicitly forbidden by the modern rubrics that was held in the 1962 Mass? Is it okay to do those things in the Novus Ordo? For example, In the Mass of 1962, in the Missal of 1962, the priest would make the sign of the cross during the absolution prayer in the Confiteor, but the general instruction of the Roman Missal is silent on this subject. And another example is kissing the cruet and blessing it with the sign of the cross during the offertory.
Yeah, there is where I would certainly say the priest should follow the current rubrics that are in the Missal for that rite, because it's so important that the priest appear as well as do what is required of him. Now, it's true, it doesn't explicitly say it's forbidden. To give you a more practical example, the current rubrics that when the Blessed Sacrament is exposed, say in the monstrance, in the old law, it was mandatory that you do what they call double genuflection, that you be on both knees for a moment. The new regulation is required the minimum of a single genuflection. But if you're going to do a double, it's not wrong. I don't find it inappropriate. It's just it's no longer required to do the double. But in what you refer to, the certain, like, there was signs of the cross the priest made during the Roman canon. It's reduced down to one sign of the cross that the priest makes, regardless of which Eucharistic prayer he uses. The kissing of the hand, not only at the cruet, but when he was incensing. If you go to extraordinary form, you'll see the deacon kiss the hand of the priest. These are rubrics that are not just absent, I would say purposely, intentionally absent, so you don't want to introduce into the sacred liturgy. Now, Pope Benedict XVI had made some comments and was working towards having both the ordinary and extraordinary affect each other, but it never got further than that that stage there. So until it becomes the official law. So I would say if it's something that appears so different from the previous rite. Now, I've seen people in the pew make the sign of the cross. They do. It's not what's supposed to be done. I, as a priest, should not be doing it. People should not be holding hands during the Our Father. But I am not going to be giving out parking tickets to people if they do that during Mass.
Are priests allowed to wear albs with lace during Mass? And if so, what should they wear under it?
Listen, I got some good stuff here, all right? I'm Italian, and we like... But as a dear priest friend of mine, Father Mike Roach, would often say, make sure it's manly lace, okay? You don't want anything to look too girly, like your grandmother's doily. But it's not forbidden. You're allowed to wear a lace alb, or you can wear just a plain alb. But what's under the alb, okay, if you're wearing lace, then you should have a cassock, because then the cassock goes with the lace. If you have an alb that has lace but it has a little black satin behind it, you don't need to. You could wear just your trousers or something like that. But I'm just talking about good taste and looking good. In terms of the requirement, the cassock is not required as it was in the old rite, that you should wear the cassock, then the alb. You can wear your black trousers if you're a priest and your black clerical shirt and put the alb on top of it. But for instance, the amice, okay? The amice was originally designed to protect the alb from the sweat and perspiration, but also to hide the collar. Well, now they've made these newer albs that cover up the collar. You don't need the amice, but I still like the amice because not only for the practical, but the spiritual. There was a prayer you said I put on the helmet of salvation. The cincture is not required or necessary, but it has a symbolic value, the cord of chastity. That's what it represents. So there's a lot of things that are optional that you can do, and there's beautiful prayers that go with it. But the gestures, like you mentioned, I would stick to what is urgently important.
Again, it's a very special mailbag edition of EWTN's Open Line Monday with Father John Trigilio. So we're not taking your phone calls today. If you'd like to be part of a future mailbag show, simply send us an email, openline@ewtn.com. It's Open Line Monday with Father John Trigilio.
This is Open Line on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Today's Open Line is recorded, so no calls, please. If you'd like to send us an email for a future show, the address is openline@ewtn.com.
That's right. We're not taking your calls today, but if you'd like to be part of a future mailbag episode, send us an email. The email address is openline@ewtn.com. Father John, when this airs, it'll be the first Monday. It'll be the first week of Lent. Give us some of your reflections.
My future's so bright,
I gotta wear shades. There you go. Unfortunately, they won't see the video for this week's open line, but that's okay. File that away for a future episode. Talk a little bit about kicking off another season of Lent and perhaps how we should really approach that.
Yes, Lent is not meant to be a spiritual Olympics, so you're not trying to impress yourself, God, or others. So when people are thinking of acts of mortification and penance, this isn't a show. I would often, when I was a pastor, say to parishioners, okay, why are you doing this? And I would often have people who were had some health issues or because of their age, or say a woman is pregnant or she's nursing a child, say, look, you need to modify your penance, because the purpose of penance is acts of mortification I do to engender sorrow for my previous sins. Mortification is self-denial that I do to prepare myself for future temptations. And the acts that we do are symbolic. So if you have health issues and you have to take medicine, let's say you're diabetic and you have to eat so many meals, or you have to take medicine when you eat these meals, or make sure you have something to eat when you take the pills, you going on a bread and water fast is not a holy idea, okay? On the other hand, if somebody is completely healthy and, you know, they're not into self-denial, then maybe some good self-denial would be good, and in that, it's not necessarily cutting out certain foods or how many meals. I said, if you follow what the church says, fasting is one full meal, two smaller ones, that if you put them together, don't equal the full one, that's fine. It's not going on a starvation diet. Denying yourself sleep, especially if you have a job or you've got a family to raise, they need you at your prime. So if you're a doctor and you're going to do heart surgery or brain surgery, I don't want you sleeping on the floor the night before because it's Lent. I want you at your best. But acts of that we do, prayer, fasting, and almsgiving, all three are valid and encouraged during the holy season of Lent. So increasing not just our prayer time, but our prayer quality. So it's not the amount, but the zeal with which I pray. Fasting, as I defined, as the church does, fasting, giving up something for Lent. But again, it's me giving up a candy bar just because it's Lent. You know, I remember when I was in third grade, I said to sister, I'm giving up beating up my brother. And she said, you can't do that. You're not supposed to be doing it anyway. I said, well, I guess she gave me a freebie there. I can go home and punch my brother. She said, no, that's not what I mean. And almsgiving, and St. Thomas Aquinas differentiates and says, actually, it's alms deeds, which is more encompassing than giving money to the poor, to the needy. Although that's one way of doing it. You could give to your parish, you give to your diocesan appeal, you can give to any number of valid charities. But also, any of the corporal and spiritual works of mercy are alms deeds. So if I spend some time at the soup kitchen, or I go visit somebody who's sick, or if I go to the nursing home, that's an alms deed. And so it's not limited to me putting money in a little cardboard box. Although that's one method of doing it. But prayer, fasting, and almsgiving are the three traditional ways in which we can honor Lent. Going to Mass an extra day of the week, certainly valuable. But if you can't physically get there because of your schedule, watch it on television. Listen to it again on streaming. Doing like my family, we used to have the family rosary every day in Lent. We would do this right after dinner. That was a nice practice. So there are many things that can be done, but always check these things out with your confessor or spiritual director.
All right, Father, we are going through these 100 questions that were sent to us.
Are we
by
down to 95 now, or what?
No, I don't think we're quite that far yet. We're ticking them off every once in a while when we have a mailbag opportunity. The next couple questions about the Novus Ordo reflect reference paragraph 274 of the general instructions. So I'm just going to read that before we tackle these next two questions. Paragraph 274 in the general instruction of the Roman Missal says, "A genuflection may be made by bending the right knee to the ground signifies adoration, and therefore it is reserved for the Most Blessed Sacrament, as well as for the Holy Cross from the solemn adoration during the liturgical celebration on Good Friday until the beginning of the Easter Vigil. During Mass, three genuflections are made by the priest celebrant, namely, after the showing of the host, after the showing of the chalice, and before communion. Certain specific features to be observed in a concelebrated Mass are noted in their proper place." So he writes in, "If the tabernacle is in the sanctuary, should the priest, when he incenses the altar at the beginning of Mass, genuflect when he passes in front of the tabernacle as he is walking around the altar? The general instruction of the Roman Missal says that there is no genuflecting during Mass, but since Mass hasn't started yet, when he is incensing the altar, shouldn't he genuflect? And during the offertory, when he is incensing the altar, should the priest bow to the altar once he's made a complete circle around it, or if the altar is pushed against the wall when he passes in front of the middle of the altar?"
Well, that's a very good question. I think I remember this question came up when Father Briganti and I were working on Catholic Mass for Dummies, and our little research found that the requirement, okay, that mandatory that the priest genuflect at those points that you mentioned, okay, when he's at the Eucharistic prayer. Now, it says that the priest may genuflect whenever he passes in front of the tabernacle, or because it's during Mass, okay, you could give a bow, all right, to acknowledge the presence of the real of the Blessed Sacrament there, but it's no longer mandatory. Now, in the old rite, you had to genuflect every time you passed by the tabernacle. In the ordinary form, the Novus Ordo, that's been lifted. But if someone does it, you know, again, I don't think it's a violation of rubrical law. But I can also see if somebody's carrying something, like say the guy with the crucifix, if he's got the processional cross, he should just bow. Because if he genuflects with that thing, the one that they use at the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception in Washington, D.C., have you ever seen how big that thing is? It is enormous. It's bigger than the actual cross of Christ. That's how big it is. You don't want that guy genuflecting with that thing because he's going to knock somebody out or do some other kind of damage. So it allows for prudence and practicality there. So I would say as a priest, yeah, when I came in, if I'm going to, now, I typically, especially if I've got incense, a bow is certainly reverent if you got your hands full and you pass by the tabernacle. I don't want people to think that during Mass, Jesus isn't present, though, because he is present in the tabernacle. The sanctuary lamp is still lit. My obligation, though, to genuflect, okay, is contingent upon what's happening at that particular moment.
And then a follow-up to that, he says, "Again, I'm having trouble understanding paragraph 274, which we just read. During Mass, if someone in the sanctuary passes in front of the altar and the tabernacle, should he genuflect or bow?"
Again, I would say if it can be done reverently, properly, yes, by all means to genuflect, but it's not required. So if I was training altar servers, I would say if you're not carrying anything, you genuflecting, I find nothing reprehensible to that, about that. But the same token, if somebody does it, I don't want them to think if they're at another parish where it's not being done, oh, this guy doesn't believe in the real presence. No, we don't want that to, because that's not the case. But a good bow, certainly of the waist, should always be given in that case. Because if a priest, say, can't genuflect because he's got injured knees or legs or back, he's required to bow if he can't genuflect. But it should be a bow of the waist. We bow the head at the name of Jesus, but a bow of the waist to honor either the altar or acknowledge the real presence.
If there's a crucifix on the altar or and another on the wall, which crucifix is incensed?
I guess whichever one you want. That's why you had some crazy liturgist saying when I was in the seminary, there should only be one crucifix, not to confuse people. People are not that dense, okay? It should be the one that's most visible, because I like to have a cross, because Pope Benedict encouraged that you have a cross, a crucifix on the altar, so the priest could look at and meditate while he's celebrating Mass. But most people in the pew won't be able to see that. If the processional cross is in the sanctuary, but it's not that visible, I would incense the most obvious, most visible crucifix that's in the sanctuary, because that's the one people are going to be looking at.
You know, here at the Our Lady of the Angels Chapel here in Irondale, they have, I've always liked it, I'm assuming it's fine. The friars wouldn't do anything that's not fine, right? But on the altar in the chapel, there is a crucifix that stands upright on the altar. It has a corpus both facing the celebrant and facing the people.
Yes, I've loved that, and I actually bought one years ago when Father Briganti was a pastor in New Jersey, because this way the people see it and the priest sees it, but we see, you know, from our vantage point. I know that somebody back in the 1970s was insisting that that was inappropriate because you got two Jesuses on the same cross. I said, listen, it's an artistic thing here, okay? We're not saying that two Jesuses died on Good Friday. People are not that dense.
What is the red cord or rope that is worn around the necks of some altar servers?
Around the neck?
That's right.
The only ones I've seen is where they've worn a medal, okay? Some parishes, in fact, one parish I help out on weekends sometimes here in Maryland, the boys have like a cross. It looks like the cross that Pope Francis wore, and then the girls have like a miraculous medal. The only time I've seen them with that red cord or rope was that it had a medal, so just so that people could distinguish that they were not an extraordinary minister of Holy Communion, they weren't a seminarian. It was just something that, again, it's never, you don't find this in the rubrics. It was something that, you know, it was done. I don't even see it in Rome at all, just mostly in the United States.
And then what is the purpose of red cassocks and who can wear them?
That one is completely at the discretion of the priest, the pastor. When I was a pastor, I would reserve the black cassocks and the white surplice for the high school boys, and because you know you still want to encourage them to think about the priesthood, because we had both boys and girls in the diocese as servers. I had the red cassock and surplice for the kids who were not in high school, and both boys and girls. Now, some places, the boys have cassocks, and then the girls have, which would be look like an equivalent of an alb, but then they also had like a scapular on the front and back. So there's a couple of options there, but there's nothing rubrically or in liturgical law that says anybody of like only seminarians could wear the black cassock. But I think it's good to make that distinction. The seminarian is different from the other servers, and I do like it being able to make a distinction between the boy servers and the girl servers too.
I've seen the red come out during the Triduum at some places.
I've seen that, and in Rome, the altar servers, the altar boys in Rome, they actually wear a purple cassock. They look like little Monsignors.
Can any minister wear lace surplices, and also can a cincture be worn either over the cassock or under it?
The cincture meaning like the sash, the fascia?
I guess. I was thinking of the cord, but...
Okay, the cord is usually the rope that's worn over the alb when one's vesting with an alb. Sometimes the word, they use the same word cincture for the sash that's over the cassock. That's, again, somewhat optional in there. And what was the other part of the question?
Just about the cincture being worn over the cassock and either under or over the surplice. which made me think, I think they're talking more about the cord.
Okay, the only time that I've seen the cord is on the alb itself, and it keeps it in place because sometimes they're more ample, and this makes it a little bit more easy to walk, so you don't trip over it. And then the sash, which is sort of like a cord, but it's a flat material that is worn over the cassock, that would always be worn underneath the surplice. You would never wear it on top of the surplice.
Should a minister during Mass bow toward the priest celebrant if he walks in front of him?
Yes, I would say that would be appropriate. I don't think it's mandatory, but obviously if there's ever a bishop there, anyone should always bow to the bishop. First, you should reverence Jesus first. So when they come up, and let's say someone's coming to do the reading or they're bringing up the gifts at the offertory, the reverence to God comes first, and then a bow to the bishop. And if there's no bishop, you could certainly do it to the priest.
I'm guessing that our emailer is a convert and has been taking notes at Mass, and if they don't understand something, they want to ask Father Trigilio
God bless them.
The next question is, and I've never considered this, but now I'm curious. Can the corporal be placed on the altar before Mass begins?
It should not, but it is done many places, and I would say, sadly, more out of laziness, but properly speaking, the corporal should be in the burse. That's that little thing looks like a bellows that's usually placed on top of the chalice and on top of the chalice veil. And I know a lot of times, when I was ordained in 1988, I couldn't find a burse. They didn't make them anymore. That's how rare they became. Now guys get them very easily. But the burse usually matches the same color of the chalice veil that matches the color of the chasuble. And the corporal would be kept in there. The priest or deacon would take it out, place it on the altar at the time of preparation of the gifts or the offertory. Some places leave the same corporal out all the time. I don't like that for a number of reasons. One, it looks a little sloppy. It gets dirty easily. And you're not saving a lot of time in doing that. And I like the ritual of opening up the corporal, okay? Because you're setting the sacred altar for the sacrifice. But I know it is done in many places I've helped out. I've seen it, and you know, if it was up to me, I wouldn't do it that way.
You know, these things make impressions. They make impressions.
They do.
Especially on younger children. I remember a dear Monsignor when we were in Des Moines, Iowa, who was in his 90s and almost legally blind when we knew him. And he grew up in Cleveland, and he tells a story often about in the winter, they had 8 kids in the family, and Mom would get all 8 of those kids all bundled up. It would take her a half hour. They would walk up the hill to the local parish. They would go to Mass. She would unbundle them. Mass was over. She would bundle them back up, and they would march back down to their house. And he said that his lasting impression of that was always thinking that this must be really important.
Exactly. And, you know, the little things we do, like the ablution cup, that little cup of holy water next to the tabernacle, it should be there for a practical purpose, because then the priest or deacon can purify their thumb and forefinger in case there's any particles. But again, it's also a ritual ablution. It's so people look at that and they wonder, why is that there? Well, then you have a wonderful teaching opportunity to explain that, you know, I touched the Blessed Sacrament. And, you know, I would often encourage, if I was in a place where there were extraordinary ministers, you should do the same. Even if you can't see the particle, all right, you washing your fingers in that special cup of holy water, it's a ritual gesture that has meaning.
You know, I always find it personally really edifying when a priest or a deacon is very deliberate during the purification of the vessels, you know, after communion has been distributed, as opposed to, you know, you just see some folks that, you know, I won't apply motive to anybody, but there are some that will rifle through that as though they were trying to demonstrate their dexterity in completing the task.
Well, yeah, and I have to say this because I'm a seminary professor. We have to also avoid the other extreme where we had some guys, they were like, they would spend 10, 15 minutes purifying.
Yeah.
And the one guy, he was looking down the patent like he was looking down a gun barrel. You got to use some common sense, obvious reverence but you don't want to go overboard because there's always anything that's not visible, okay? It's still Jesus, yes. The real presence doesn't cease, but if it's not visible, your obligation, okay, ceases there to give it that kind of reverence. So, because we had a guy here, he used to get a sun lamp and examine everything. Literally, I'm not kidding you. He would take it up and hold it. Oh, wait, mate, well, it could have been a piece of dust. But if it does, if it could possibly, yes, you want to purify reverently.
I want to invite you to check out The Journey Home with John Mark Grody tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern Time on EWTN Radio and Television. John Mark and his guests discuss their personal journeys home back to the Catholic Church. Very, very edifying program. The Journey Home with John Mark Grody tonight, 8 Eastern on EWTN Radio and Television. All right, Father, again, a special mailbag edition of Open Line Monday, so we're not taking your calls today. The next in our hit parade of 100 questions from our very sincere emailer, and I'm going to paraphrase this because he references several paragraphs in the general instruction of the Roman Missal, but here's the gist of it. The gist of it is that you will see during a daily Mass if a priest is by himself or maybe has one minister with him. He will stay behind the altar essentially for almost the entirety of the liturgy. And he's wanting to know, first of all, if that's kosher. And if it is kosher, could you do that no matter how many ministers you had?
Okay, he's talking about the priest not sitting in the chair?
That's right.
Okay, I've done that myself on occasion. For instance, I had to celebrate Mass just recently. One of the seminarians was busy driving speakers from the airport to our retreat we had here with 1,000 young people, and he wasn't going to be able to make the Mass that was going to be celebrated at the time. So I offered a private Mass so he could get his Sunday obligation. And there is no chair. It's a side altar. you can sit in the pew, but it's kind of awkward. So I just stood there during the time that I would say normally be sitting. So and in places, many places, when you go to Rome and you celebrate as a priest, there may not be a chair, because if it is a side altar, you will not find chairs typically there. But if you're celebrating Mass in the main body of the church, I would say it's appropriate to use the chair. I don't think that it's mandatory. Certainly it's mandatory that you be at the altar at the proper time. But I knew some priests who just, because they had a bad back, and I'm talking about very like osteoporosis, yeah, yeah, type of back, let the poor man stand if that's all he can do.
At the lavabo, should the server pour the water over the priest's fingers? Often I see a priest just dip their hands into an already existing bowl of water.
Yeah, there is no strict rubric on that. Again, if there's some books that were written in the 1950s and 1930s, a manual for serving, and it was very explicit on what to do. Bishop Elliot has written some wonderful books on what the priest should do and also what the servers would do. I said that's current. I would certainly recommend that as for reading. But in the old ritual, the extraordinary form, the altar server was to pour the water over the priest's fingers. And just like when he purified after giving a Holy Communion, the custom was the altar server would pour a little wine first over his fingers, in case there was any fragments of the Blessed Sacrament on him, and then follow it with pouring some water over his fingers. Priests today might just take the cruet and do it themselves, fill up the chalice. I've seen priests do the dipping with the water, particularly after the aftermath of the COVID. But today, in the in ordinary form, the Novus Ordo, we're not as precise on those type of regulations.
When the deacon or minister incenses the people after incensing the priest during the offertory, should he incense the other ministers and altar servers first?
He is required to do the priest first, and then any concelebrating priests, and then everyone else, okay, at one time. So you don't single out any lay servers in the sanctuary. They are considered part of the rest of the faithful. So you do the priest celebrant, you do the other priests, and then they typically go to the middle of the sanctuary facing the whole congregation. They do not separately identify, say, the other altar servers. That is not done.
And the final question on page two, Father Trigilio.
Page two.
When the priest walks around the altar, incensing it, should the deacon, if he's walking next to him, bow with him, even though he isn't the one doing the incensing?
Yes.
That was easy. There's only four left, Father. The next mailbag we do, we will knock out the 100-question email. Would you leave us with a blessing?
Benedicta vos omnipotens Deus Pater et Filius et Spiritus Sanctus. Amen.
Amen. On behalf of our host, Father John Trigilio, our producer, Pedro Quiles, I'm Jack Williams. Thanks so much for tuning in to EWTN's Open Line Monday. Keep it right here on many of these EWTN stations. Coming up next, Beacon of Truth with Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers. Hope you have a great rest of your day. God bless.